Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chris, is that you? Or is that Jessica?
It's me, Chris. Excuse me.
Hey, Chris.
Hi.
No worries. Just waiting for Jessica to hop on.
Hello?
Hi, Jessica, is that you?
Yes.
Hi. Okay. Can both of you hear me okay?
Yes.
I can. I have this on speaker. Is that okay, or should I put it on my, like, does it sound okay, or should I just take it off speaker?
I think if you could take it off speaker, that might be best. Yeah, a little bit earlier you were kind of in and out, so just to be safe.
Okay, all right.
Okay, are we good to go?
I'm ready. Are you ready, Jessica?
Yes.
Okay, so I wanted to thank you both for joining us today. Before we dive into today's discussion, I just was wondering if both of you can tell me a little bit about yourselves.
Sure, yeah. This is Chris Stark, and I'm Anishinaabe and Cherokee. And I've been doing work around sexual violence, particularly in the Native community, for a long time. I've been doing this work for just a little over 31 years now, and in a variety of different ways.
Hello.
Thanks,
my name
Chris.
Is Jessica. I'm a survivor. You want me to go?
Jessica, go ahead. Yes, please.
Okay, sorry. Well, hi. My name is Jessica. I'm a survivor. I am Native American. I have been in the life before. I have been trafficked before since I was a little girl growing up. I got out the life about 6 years ago, so not too long ago. And now I work at an organization called Breaking Free in St. Paul to help women get out of the life of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. So, yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Can I do mine over?
Sure, Chris.
Sorry. Oh, my God, I'm sorry. It's kind of not bad that they can, I mean, it's kind of not good that they can cut this out, because then it makes me, like, feel like I can mess up and not worry about it. But it's okay to do it over.
Yeah. Tell us who you are, Chris.
Okay. Yeah. So my name is Chris Stark, and I'm Anishinaabe and Cherokee. I'm a survivor of different kinds of sexual violence, including being sex trafficked by family members and others from the time that I was a very young girl, which also included being used in pornography. I've been an advocate, activist, writer, and researcher for just a little bit over 30 years around issues of sexual violence and sexual exploitation. And I've been doing a lot of that work in the Native community, focused on issues of colonization and sexual exploitation the past, I don't know, maybe 15 or 18 years.
Thank you so much, Chris, and thank you so much, Jessica, and I'm so excited to have you both with us today. I just can't even say enough about your incredible expertise. Thank you for sharing a little bit about you and who you are. So today we wanted to talk about some issues that were addressed in the report, colonization, homelessness, and the prostitution and sex trafficking of Native women. So that, of course, is the report that, Chris, you wrote with Eileen Houdon. And we want to talk about their contemporary application as well. So that report is phenomenal. If you haven't read it yet, you can access it on our website, VAWNET, VAWNET.org. And it covers the history of sex trafficking of Indigenous women, the history of homelessness for Native Indigenous women, contemporary sexual violence, homelessness, trauma, and also has some fantastic recommendations. So for both of you, we know that the rates of sexual violence against Indigenous women are horrifically high, but this is actually nothing new. So I just wanted to get started by asking if you can tell us about the history of colonization and sexual exploitation of Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people.
Yeah, so Two-Spirit, for those who might not be familiar with that term, is a term that's used often or by at least some Native people to refer to LGBTQ. And we use it interchangeably with LGBTQ. So when we talk about the history of sexual exploitation and what we now call sex trafficking, we see it in the journals of Christopher Columbus and some of the first things that he and his men did when they landed in what we now call the Caribbean was to sexually enslave women and also girls, creating concubines with the women. And he writes about that dealers were going about the land looking for girls as young as 9 and 10 years old to sell them into sex trafficking. So right away from the very beginning of the colonization and the attempted genocide of Indigenous people on this land, we see the sex trafficking and the sexual exploitation, the sexual torture of Indigenous women and girls, happened at the very outset. And when you look at the history books, you can see it going right up the East Coast and also the West Coast, as those were the first areas in what we now call the United States to be colonized. And sex trafficking, prostitution, if we use those two terms together, was institutionalized immediately. It was brought over by European men as part of European culture to view women and girls or at least some women and girls in a way that they existed in order to be used sexually by men. And we see that institutionalized as, they furthered the colonization of this land. And so it was there from the very beginning, and we are still dealing with the ramifications of that brutalization of the first Indigenous girls that the Europeans had exploited. And one of the pieces also that goes along with that that's a little bit less known is that Europeans also brutally targeted Two-Spirit people, and that at least in some Native communities or Indigenous communities, Two-Spirit or what we now call LGBTQ, they had revered places in the cultures as medicine people, and as the difference was viewed as something that made them special and powerful versus something that made that group of people degraded and less than. And so there's a lot of brutality that was inflicted against them as well.
Thank you for sharing that, Chris. I think that sometimes theoretically we may know how awful the treatment of Indigenous folks was across the country, but we don't actually always talk about it. So thinking about, war and displacement and trafficking, what was the resulting impact of this removal and replacement from the homelands and the reservations? What was the impact on Indigenous people?
Yeah, and so Eileen Houdon and I write about that in the report that you referenced, where we talk about you know, the homelessness for Indigenous people began with, of course, with, you know, the attempted genocide, the various ways that colonization encroached on our people, our land, and our lives, but being placed on reservations and being taken away from the lands where our ceremonies were performed and where our ancestors, you know, dwelled in the ground, and being removed to these small locations where there was not an ability to often, you know, feed ourselves or feed ourselves well. So our entire culture, you know, the economic, the political aspects, everything was really disrupted by, you know, taking the land and placing us on reservations, moving us all over the place, moving us to different parts of the country. And one of the things that Vine Deloria writes about is that ceremonies as being, you know, central to the culture of most people, central to Indigenous people's ways of lives. Ours is tied to the land and to the places on the land. And so we can't just like pick up and move to another part because maybe that mountain or that lake or whatever now, we're not there in order to perform that. And so all of those pieces then created this incredible instability, which again, we continue to see, and Jessica will have a lot to say about, you know, the contemporary issues of homelessness and its relationship to sex trafficking of Native women and youth.
Thank you, Chris. You know, I know you talked about the Native connection to the land and often particular places like a mountain or a lake and water. So when you think about the differences in culture of what you've said, maybe the Europeans, the Spanish, other colonizers, how does that culture differ from, you know, other Indigenous cultural values? Like what are the biggest changes?
Yeah, and so, again, you know, we can't speak for all 500-plus, you know, tribes or nations that exist now, and then some of them were entirely wiped out. But what we see as, you know, core to Anishinaabe ways and core to a lot of other Indigenous cultures is a view of women as being sacred. We're life givers. We have the ability to give life. And we're whole and we're complete in that way. And so that's really revered and honored. And then children as gifts from the Creator. And so women and children were typically or at least often not viewed as property and as something that was owned, managed, and controlled by men. There was a lot more integrity and individuality given to women and children. So it was a very different viewpoint. And then you come in with a Christian-based ideology, you know, of these European cultures that viewed women and children as literal chattel, as property, owned and controlled by men and there to, you know, better the lives of the men. And those differences and then the sexual conquest that went along with that European Christian viewpoint of women was really in opposition to many of the tribes that have been living here for, you know, many thousands of years. I just, it's very important for people to understand that because it's important for people to understand the truth of Indigenous culture and values. But it's also important because when we're looking to make a way forward, because we're all here together now, there are other ways to live in which, you know, men are not being taught and then, you know, acting out brutal sexual behaviors towards women and children.
Thank you, Chris. So something that you mentioned in the report that I think is a really interesting and awful part of U.S. history that we don't always discuss is the concept of Native boarding schools. So, you know, Native boarding schools really founded to eliminate those traditional Native ways of life, sever people from the land, sever them from their customs and their culture. So what were some of the impacts of the boarding schools on Native children, families, and, of course, tribes?
Yeah, and so again, that was you know, the boarding school situation started. I think it was in the late 1700s, actually, when the first one was actually implemented. It may have been the early 1800s, but they were in existence at you know, very early time in the construction of the United States. And I think people tend to know, like, you know, that hair was cut and languages were forbidden, and the culture of the children and therefore of the tribe and the families was really assaulted in those ways. And then, of course, removing children from their families and their, you know, their broader community is really devastating. But what a lot of people tend to not be as familiar with is the amount of sexual violence and physical violence that was being inflicted on a good number of the children in these boarding schools. And so, again, introducing that kind of brutal ownership and violence into Native cultures through often very young children, that has a long-lasting impact, not just on the individual child that went through this, you know, 50 or 100 or 150 years ago, but that, of course, carries forward intergenerationally, you know, as someone is assaulted like that, they need to do the healing, and the healing's not available because the culture has been, you know, displaced, and so that just carries down. It doesn't mean that they were all sexually abusive to their children, but the harm that is caused by that goes forward in a variety of ways in a community. And you can read more about that at the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Report, which is online. And they talk about medical experimentation being performed on Canadian First Nation children in these boarding schools. They talk about outright sex trafficking of Native children in these boarding schools by priests, clergy, politicians, and businessmen. And so, again, when we look at the history of Indigenous people and what has been done to Indigenous people by European cultures, really we see almost the same thing happening now, almost the same things being done in the same kinds of ways in our communities now.
I think that's such an important point, Chris. You know, everything that you've shared has these really long-lasting implications, and I think sometimes there's just this push to, like, write history off as just being history, but, you know, violence is all interconnected. People who are harmed can often do harm. And, you know, this is just a vicious cycle, and healing is so complicated, especially when you talk about, you know, this complete removal of the customs, the culture, the Native connection to land. So moving away from history, what are the contemporary ramifications of the history of sexual exploitation of Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people?
Jessica, do you want to jump in on this one?
Yes. Well, I was just going to say about the concept about, let me read that question over. It says, I'm reading the questions on the email, but can you, like, explain what the meaning of colonization and exploitation means to me? About how, you know, how does that, are you asking me, can you, like, reassure the question?
The contemporary ramifications? Yeah, so,
yeah.
Like, just talking about, like, what is the legacy, or how has, the history of the sexual exploitation, how is that carried forward now? So, like, what are we seeing in the community now in terms of sexual exploitation of Native women and youth, Two-Spirit? Does that make more sense?
Yeah, I just believe, like, it's becoming something that people already know that we are, that we are just homeless all the time. We are, you know, sex traffic, you know, and it feels like Native women and children were just targeted, you know, and it feels like it's just a thing that people know, that we're vulnerable, we're more you know, willing because of our history and our traumas. And it feels like that's how I feel about my trauma in life, that I feel like it came from generational and that people already have me down as a target, you know, trafficked or when I was younger. Knowing that who my generation and what I came from or what it was, it just feels like it's not, it's just normalized now.
Yeah.
When it shouldn't be. Especially with Two-Spirit people, especially Two-Spirit people, they're more vulnerable also because, you know, they both go, you know, and people just don't see the difference in them type, you know, they just, it's just not, it's just, it's hard out, it's hard to explain, I'm sorry, but yeah, it's just unnormalized, it seems like now, that we are just,
no, yeah, don't.
Yeah,
don't be sorry,
I,
Jessica.
I think that's...
Thank you for, yeah, just thank you for sharing that and your experience. I think it's just so connected to everything that Chris shared. But Chris, do you want to share more about the contemporary aspects of, you know, what sexploitation has led to?
Sure. Jessica, do you want me to talk a little bit about the Garden of Truth? Like, do you want me to give a few, like, just talk a moment about that, and then you just jump in wherever you want around that.
Sure.
Okay. So MIW or MUSAC and an organization called PRE. We did a report on the Garden of Truth, the prostitution and sex trafficking of Native women. And in that, we see those contemporary ramifications of this history, the carrying forward of the kinds of attitudes that Jessica, you know, is talking about, where Native women and youth and Two-Spirit people are often viewed by, you know, particularly white men as being targeted or as being, this is what you exist for. And in the Garden of Truth, we interviewed 105 Native women in prostitution and trafficking in Minnesota, and the rate of homelessness of either previous or current homelessness was 98%. 92% of the women wanted to get out immediately but were unable to do so. 72% had symptoms of dissociation. 52% had PTSD rates that were in the same range with combat war veterans. And the majority of the women had been first abused as girls by an average of 4 perpetrators. So, again, we see exactly what Jessica is talking about, is this this idea that was brought forward by, you know, Christian beliefs that viewed Native women as essentially as prostitutes, or what the term was squaws at the time. And we see that being carried forward, you know, in the kinds of ideas that live in our culture today and then are acted out against our women and children.
Yeah, and I have so much resemblance of that because we are indigenous, and that's it feels like that part of all that together, Two-Spirit, us, women, children, our generation of that is just feels like it's just normalized, obviously. And with me being, you know, perpetrated by men when I was younger, makes it normalized to me as a Native woman, and makes it seem like it's normalized for me since I was young. So that it starts with the children, the women and the children, because they see what other women going through. The children look up to their mom and their mom, you know, being trafficked. So that's what normalized, it's just normalized. And that's how I feel about my situation and how I got out the life and all that, and how I got in the life of being trafficked, because I thought it was normalized because of generations and my parents and my family. And I feel like the aspect I didn't know because I was obviously adopted when I was younger, so a lot of that was different, but I went back to my people and my tribe, and I fell back into it and thought that was normalized while I was around, and everybody just felt like this is us, and it's sad that we have to go through this, but our trauma behind it is very long, and it's not, it shouldn't be normalized.
Yeah, I had, you know, with my situation too, it was, you know, intergenerational, and it was family involvement with, you know, a few members in the family being perpetrators. But when you have that, you know, continuing throughout the family, and you have such an amount of control over the family, and then there's domestic violence, there's incest, there's all of these other forms of sexual violence that, I mean, they're all the same. You can't separate them. You can't be like, well, you know, last night it was incest and then tonight it's sex. You know what I mean? They're all intermingled, and we saw that so much with the Garden of Truth too, especially, you know, the incest, the childhood sexual abuse is really being at the base or center of that. And then also really high rates of domestic violence, which would cause women to get into prostitution or trafficking. It would make them more vulnerable to that, or they were actually being bought and sold by boyfriends or husbands. And so, you know, like Jessica's saying, it's this kind of swirling motion that has been going on in our communities. And, you know, we're still trying to find the balance and find the healing despite all of these generations of violence. And I think
it
it's
really
also important
is.
For people to understand that the vast majority of perpetrators, whether it's domestic violence, rape, murder, or prostitution and sex trafficking, the vast majority of perpetrators against Native women and children are not Native men. It's like what we found in our report, Garden of Truth, it was primarily white men and then secondarily African-American men. So that's also important to put out there, because otherwise people bring some, you know, sort of previous racist ideas about Native men as well. Not that there aren't Native men involved in sexual, you know, being sexually violent, but it's important for people to understand that, again, this is still being perpetrated by people outside of our community, primarily.
Yeah, that's a super important point, Chris. I think it just highlights also everything that you've already shared, that, you know, this is history just repeating itself, and what Jessica shared, like, it just becomes the norms, and it's awful, but it's really hard to untangle when it's been, as you said, swirling around forever and just a cycle that continues. Something that came up for me, Chris, you mentioned the Garden of Truth. You mentioned the incredibly high rates of homelessness for Native women, youth, and Two-Spirit individuals. So could you talk a little bit more about that intersection of homelessness, that contemporary homelessness intersecting with sexual exploitation?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about it, but I Jessica, do you want to talk about that first, since you've been doing the outreach and stuff?
Yeah, so about the homelessness and being homeless and dealing with sexual exploitation is actually combined, I feel like, because being homeless, you're more vulnerable, especially not talking about the camps yet, but for me, it's just like people in the community, in like how we're just vulnerable and we're homeless and we are addicts and all that stuff combined, it seems like, because we're out in the streets, we're vulnerable, that's how we survive. And people, you know, the white man, they know that, you know, the person, whoever is the perpetrator, knows that, they know the history, I feel like, half the time, or if they don't, they figure it out. Just us being homeless is more vulnerable, especially with no housing, being vulnerable in the streets and feeling like that's all you can do to survive, or it's normalized because that's all we know. is that's the hard part. And being out in outreach and seeing women out there, and they're vulnerable, and they're, you know, they want to get out to life, but it's so hard, especially when I see women out there in the streets. They want to get out, but it's like, it's so hard because they don't know what normal is, because that's their normal. So when they're out there, people don't understand that this is not where they want to be. This is not that they chose this life. It feels like it's been chosen for us. And so we really, really get deep, and it's a culture, and get back into our culture ways and our native ways to help them heal. There's no other way right now. I feel like housing is a big step in healing and getting out of the life of prostitution, is healing in our cultural ways.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that there's been more attention brought to the situation in Minneapolis and St. Paul because of the murder of George Floyd. And, so I'm going to sum this up and hopefully get it, you know, pretty accurate. But we've had these homeless encampments for the past roughly year and a half or 2 years, and that started along the Hiawatha Wall, and that was a primarily Native camp of tents. And then what happened after that was sort of disbanded, and some people were found homes. But then what happened with the pandemic, and then with all of the chaos and the protests and the burning and the rioting of the aftermath of the George Floyd murder, of which a lot of that burning of the buildings was done by people who were part of white supremacist movements. There's another homeless camp. There are multiple homeless camps that have sprung up in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And just listening to sort of the situation and the stories of what the women and youth have been going through at these camps, and then like Jessica's been talking about, like being targeted, it has just been horrific to see what has happened to, particularly Native women and youth, and also African American women and youth who are out in the streets and more vulnerable in these camps. So Jessica, I don't know if you want to say anything more about those encampments outreach.
Yeah, the encampments for sure. I feel like we are targeted there, especially because of the high rate of Native women and children being homeless. Traders and pimps and whoever, they know where to go. They know that this is where they're going to be, they're going to be up all night, let's just go over there. And this is, they know that they get what they want because we're so vulnerable and we don't have a place at home in our own bed at night. So we're more vulnerable. And seeing these women out there is so heartbreaking. We have a girl in one of our homes that came from the encampment, and she told me her experience there and how vulnerable it is to be out there, and people just know that she's a target, and how not safe it is for these women and children and even men too, that we're just a target out there, and it's been very not safe. We need more people like to come protect them and make sure that they are safe, and sorry, but to just be, the outreach is, we see a lot of Native women out there in Minneapolis and St. Paul, mostly Minneapolis, of being addicted, being homeless, and being vulnerable and not safe. And these men know that this is going on. They know to just pull up over there in a car, and, they know what to do, and they will get the younger ones first and then the older ones, because they're already vulnerable, and the younger ones are way more vulnerable. So just hearing the experience from one of the girls, she is a youth, a Native, coming from the encampment, It's very sad because it seems like people were trying to separate people, Natives over here, the Black over here, and it was not safe because if one person was not looked Native, they were not mentioned to be Native. That's how she felt, and she told me a little bit about that. And all Indigenous, you know, we're all color, a different color, but we are still the same. And there is a lot of sex trafficking out there with the Native girls, and she was in the Camden for 6 years, so just imagine all the trauma she's been through and being normalized to that and being in a tent is normal for her, and it should never be, but that's what our generations and all that trauma is like. We're just normal. This is normal. We'll get through it, you know, but we really need that cultural behind it, all the healing and all that. If there was more cultural healing and people was more harm reduction, I feel like people would really understand us more and hear us through. And being a survivor and having working at a survivor-led place is way more comfortable for women to come and just feel like they're not judged. So we need more places that are survivor-led and more housing that people have been through the same stuff, and we understand, not just going to school, and we really need more people out in the streets to see this.
Thank you, Jessica. I think it's so important. You know, you highlighted so many threads of what's happening right now. You know, the crisis of homelessness and housing instability continues to worsen. The vulnerability of people who are homeless or housing unstable, you know, just continues to worsen. You know, we haven't really talked today about how we're in a pandemic, and that's affecting everyone across the country in different and awful ways. And, you know, the effects of that are really felt by Indigenous folks everywhere. And the idea of being in an encampment where you're so vulnerable to, you know, everything that comes with being homeless and housing unstable and then sexual violence is just awful. But Jessica, I know you started to get us there. I just wanted to point out this quote that I really love from the report that Chris and Eileen wrote. It says, quote, "More awareness, research, creation of effective services and public policies are needed to right the wrongs inflicted on Native women and therefore Native communities. Prostitution and sex trafficking were not part of Indigenous cultures before European contact," end quote. So I know you started to get into it, Jessica, thinking about survivor-led solutions, survivor-responsive solutions, but what are some of your recommendations and solutions? And that's either of you. Feel free to chime in.
I just feel like we need more people that have been through the life. Obviously, survivor-led is very important. I feel like the place I work at, we're all survivor-led, and it feels like more women are willing to come and not feel judged when they come into our organization. More people need to be an outreach and understand what's going on in this world and the pandemic and all this stuff that's going around them. Even people that live by the encampment should be aware of what's going on and not judgmental. I just feel like the encampments and being a survivor, us going out there, people really need to get out there and see that this is real, this is real life, and they probably did not know that this was this serious until the pandemic and George Floyd, and now all these tents are out. And people don't see all these homeless, they see homeless people, but they don't see them, they don't know who is homeless, and you know, until they've seen these encampments and tents, and they were like, wow, this is a lot of people, now they want to help, you know. And it's been like that for so many years, but it takes a whole, you know, pandemic or something to happen for somebody to really see us through with things. Like, even if we go out there to the Capitol or whatever we do, it seems like nobody will understand unless we all come together as one and show them that this is real. Just like MMIW, you know, that was never a task force until they fought and showed that this is serious. And the cold case office in Bloomington and all that stuff is like, now they're finally recognizing that this is true. This is real. This is not just a thing that we're just talking about. It's real life.
Yeah, and it's amazing how like you're talking about, Jessica, this is becoming more visible. And it's just amazing that still in this day and age, we can have Indigenous women, we can have African-American women, white women, you know, who are being exploited out on the streets or being exploited in other ways, be murdered and dumped in neighborhoods. And, like, there's really, like, it's a blip. I can think of six or seven mostly Native African-American women who have been murdered and their bodies dumped in my neighborhood. And, like, there's no outcry. There's no... That really, there might be a little article in the paper and that's it. The neighbors don't respond to it, you know, and this, you know, I'm on the edge of I live in a community of color, but I'm on the edge of a upper middle class white area where two young Native women's bodies have been dumped and there was no reaction from the community at all. So it is really astonishing how this continues on. But like Jessica said, you know, awareness is starting to be raised around it.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Jessica. You know, I thank you so much for everything that you've shared. I always hope, you know, anyone that finds a report like the colonization report that Chris and Eileen wrote or the Garden of Truth or the other reports that you mentioned, Chris, or even just stumbling upon this podcast will really be a helpful step in, you know, starting to educate folks on the horrific history that has happened to the Indigenous community and really reflect on what's happening currently and how, you know, it's a never-ending cycle that really needs to be broken and how we need to do exactly more of what both of you have mentioned. So I just wanted to thank you again for your time, for your expertise. You know, if there's nothing else, then we can go ahead and wrap up for today.
I would really like to emphasize what, you know, Jessica said, and that is the need for survivor-led and also for culturally appropriate and specific services for Native women and youth who are being exploited. And the other thing I want to say as well is that I don't want people to leave this thinking that, you know, with a sort of, you know, victim view of Native people in the sense that there's a ton of amazing things going on in Native communities of revitalizing language and ceremonies and Native culture, you know, being restored and coming back, which of course is being done by Native people. And the power and the beauty and the strength of Native cultures and Native ceremonies, that's what brought by far the most healing that I have received throughout my lifetime. That's what kind of gave me, quote unquote, life again. And so I just want to kind of also put that out there because and Native ways and Native people, you know, we're still here and we still have, you know, our cultures going forward despite everything that we've been through. And it's they're very beautiful and powerful and wonderful ways of living.
Thank you so much for that, Chris. Such an important point. Anything else, Jessica, that you want to add to remind our listeners of?
Yeah, I just would want to remind them that we are all the same. We just want to put out there that this is what's going on. We don't want to, you know, we just want people to know the truth behind all this, that we're not just talk. It's real, and I want them to know that the background of it, and we're not just making this stuff up, and that we are very powerful, and that we come from a very powerful culture, and that our culture is very healing within us, and that we need more of it, especially what Chris said about getting out the life and giving our life back, feeling like life's back, the music, the powwows, all that, the ceremonies. We all need that, being Native and coming back to our Native ways. It's very powerful within our souls, feel like. I just feel like they need more cultural cultural housing, healing, harm reduction, and showing and giving people a chance before they just end, you know, just don't mess with them at all. They need to see what we've been through and how, what's the best way to heal that. And that's the best way.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Chris. Again, thanks for your time today. I hope that your wisdom and expertise, you know, gets shared far and wide. Thank you for your work, and I know we'll continue to be in touch. So thank you both.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.